Hoping for a high of 69 with gusty northeast winds. Right now, wind northeast at 12, gusting to 32. Light rain, 64 Kenosha, 63 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited about the opportunity we have to explore the life and especially the final years of one of the most intriguing figures in world history and someone whose name we know well. But beyond the name, a lot of us do not know what we should know about Alexander the Great. He, of course, was an incredibly successful conqueror. But one of the things that is often neglected is the final period of his life, specifically the last 7 years, when Alexander the Great, rather than resting on his laurels, began expanding his empire still further, and along the way experiencing some terrible setbacks, some dispiriting defeats, and increasing controversy surrounded him. But it was also a fascinating exploration of the world, a transformation of himself and his huge army. And this story is told in riveting fashion in a brand new book called Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. The author of this book is Rachel Kauser, chair of the Classics Department at the Graduate Center at City University of New York, and she is also a professor of ancient art and archaeology at Brooklyn College. She is responsible for several previous books, including The Afterlives of Greek Sculpture, Interaction, Transformation, Destruction. And she is also the author of Hellenistic and Roman Ideal Sculpture, The Allure of the Classical. She is stepping well beyond just the realm of classical art to bring this intriguing figure of Alexander the Great thrillingly to life. Her book is published by Marina Books, again titled Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. Rachel Kauser, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I wonder if, ahead of talking about your book, we could find out a little bit about what fueled your initial interest in ancient history and the classical world. Did anything in particular draw your attention and inspire you to devote your career to this particular academic pursuit?
Yeah, absolutely. I was one of those kids who was obsessed with Greek mythology. I had this beautiful book when I was little, the Dolores Book of Greek Myths, which has these gorgeous woodcut illustrations and really interesting, kid-sanitized versions, but fascinating, of Greek mythology. And I loved it so much, we actually had to go out and buy a second copy eventually because I read it to pieces. So that was one thing that really got me hooked at a young age. And the other is that my hometown museum, I'm a Californian, my hometown museum was the Getty, which, if you've ever been there, it's this beautiful recreation of a Roman villa from Herculaneum on the coast of the Pacific. And so we would go to the museum, and then we would go to the beach, and that's like the total Pavlovian conditioning for a love of Greek art. So, those two early experiences were really important for me.
Very good. You are talking in this book and in most of what you have written about events long, long ago. In the case of this particular facet of Alexander's life, we're talking about the last 7 years of his life, from 330 BC mm-hmm. to 323 BC. This is more of a kind of a general question, but I also am very curious to know in relation to Alexander himself. What is it that we can firmly know about events from that long ago and people who lived that long ago versus what must we, in a sense, infer? And particularly when it comes to someone as famous as Alexander the Great, what survives him? What is most valuable? What was most valuable to you in crafting this particular book?
Good question. And it is an important one that I wrestled a lot with, which is how do we know what we know? So the first thing to say is that Alexander was so famous, both in his era and ever afterwards, that everybody who was connected with him wrote a kind of campaign memoir. Think JFK. And so we have the accounts of some of his most famous generals, the commander of his navy, but also like one of his architects, his dream interpreter. And yes, that is a Macedonian like position in the army. So we have all this kind of granular detail about him, which allows us to say things like his favorite book was the Iliad. His favorite hobbies were like running and hunting. We know how he dressed. We know a lot of detail about with whom he slept, and some of those details are quite spicy, as I get into in my book. But so that was really important to me, and we have these literary sources, none of them firsthand, all quoted by later sources. The other thing that was really important to me was archaeology and how, particularly for understanding the kind of Persian side of things, we have a lot of material remains which gave us a much better sense of what the conquest was like for the conquered.
So did anything in particular draw you to this aspect of Alexander's life? And, I mean, obviously part of the point is told in the subtitle, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. And obviously they are not literally forgotten or completely forgotten, but certainly to some extent forgotten, maybe neglected. Is that what drew you to want to focus on these particular years of his life?
That was part of it. And the other part was that this is the period of Alexander's life where we really see the classical world that I was so familiar with, the world of Greece and Rome, which is often presented, you know, you talk about Athens, you talk about Imperial Rome. But this is the period where we can see that world stretching out and connecting to this much bigger world that encompasses Europe, but also encompasses the Middle East and as far as South Asia. And that really, I felt, was important to sort of help people remember that this was a global age, Alexander's age, in a way that's an interesting precedent for our age. So, for instance, there's this city that I was really intrigued by, Bagram, recently the site of an American Air Force base in Afghanistan. It's been excavated, and it has this wonderful mix of, like, ivories from South Asia. It has Greek bronzes. It has Chinese lacquerware. And, you know, this is a site that Alexander rested his army at and renamed modestly after himself, Alexandria. But it really allows us to see the kind of interconnections between the classical world and the world beyond. And that, to me, was really fascinating and a key part of my book that I wanted to bring to readers, this reminder of the bigger world Alexander was part of.
And I agree with you. That's one of the things that is especially intriguing, is to read this detailed account of the way in which he encountered worlds and cultures vastly different from his own. You obviously have a great background in classical art. You've written extensively, especially about sculpture. Is that particular aspect of your expertise and experience helpful in crafting this particular story?
I think it has been. It's a kind of different perspective because most of the people who've worked on Alexander have focused predominantly on literary texts. So these kind of powerful men speaking to other powerful men about one of the most famous rulers in antiquity. And as an archaeologist, I was also really interested in the material remains, and they allow us to answer questions that the literary texts can't. So, for example, there's this big argument in the book that I get into more in the book about the burning of Persepolis, the great royal city of the Persians. And, you know, the literary texts disagree, so there's not so much you can do in mining them. But Persepolis is preserved. It's actually a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it was well excavated by what was then the Oriental Institute of Chicago in the 1930s. And I still vividly remember, like, sitting in the Columbia University Library, looking at these three huge volumes of excavation reports from Persepolis and thinking, you know, this is evidence that not everybody has really understood how to use. Because when you read the excavation reports, you can see how thoroughly Alexander and his men kind of looted the Persepolis of everything that was valuable and portable. You can see where they lit fires by, like, piling up cloth of gold tapestries. You can even see where they dropped little things, like some little gold rosettes in a particular staircase that was a bottleneck as they were going through the treasury. And from this, you can really understand that this was not a kind of drunken orgy. This was meticulously planned, carefully executed. And I think that tells us something about Alexander as a leader, but it also gives us this sense of, like, the devastation. I mean, all of Persepolis is covered in about 3 feet of cedar ash from the burning, of what it must have been like for the people who were conquered.
We're speaking with Rachel Kauser about her newest book, which is called Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. The book actually begins very close to the terrible event that Rachel Kauser was just describing, namely the burning of Persepolis. And it proceeds from there through the last 7 years of Alexander's life until his untimely death in the year 323 BC. Before we explore some of these specific events that you talk about in your book, I wonder if you could set the stage for us by summarizing what Alexander managed to accomplish leading up to the year 330 BC, which is essentially where your book begins.
Absolutely. So Alexander becomes king when his father is assassinated before his eyes, and as I talk more about in the book, perhaps with his connivance. Alexander is 20, and he is left with his father's ambition, which is to conquer the Persian Empire, and also his army, which is this, you know, the most effective fighting force of its era. And I love 20-year-olds. I've spent most of my life teaching them. I would never put any of them in charge of a large army. But that's what Alexander got. So, and I don't think anyone really expected him to be able to do much with it, but he stamps out resistance in Greece for a couple of years, and then heads across the Hellespont to Persia. And he has this kind of insanely successful, almost frictionless glide across the western half of the Persian Empire. He has a number of major battles, all of which he, you know, succeeds against what the Greek sources at least call amazing odds. He invades Egypt, which was then part of the Persian Empire, and is proclaimed pharaoh. It would seem like a cakewalk. And he gets to the great capitals of the Persian Empire and is, you know, essentially acknowledged as king. And that's about where most books start to talk about a kind of, either they just kind of gloss over the end of it, or they present it as this sort of degenerate aftermath of a once promising career. But to me, that's where it gets interesting. Because in my view, when Alexander becomes great is when his empire strikes back.
Right, exactly. Let me ask you to explain something that you say in the very first chapter of the book. When you say Alexander's was not the ancient world's first global empire, but it was by far the most ambitious and integrated in the years before Roman rule. I mean, I think it's easy to understand what you mean by it being by far the most ambitious. But what about that second word, integrated? In what way was it the most integrated global empire that had yet been seen?
This is one of the things that to me is most compelling about Alexander, and I think most relevant for today, which is that he realized he's got an army that's about maybe 30,000, 45 at most, and he's trying to conquer and administer an empire which is about 2 million square miles, the biggest in antiquity, even bigger than the Roman Empire, and about 30 million people. So he is not even, you know, his army is not even a rounding error in the Persian Empire. And so he realizes, I think, basically very pragmatically, that he's got to figure out how to co-opt and integrate his empire in order to successfully hold on to it. So he, from very early on, names a string of Persian governors of the various provinces. He incorporates people as high-ranking as the great king's brother into his sort of close circle of what are called the companions, who are the sort of ruling elite of his empire. He integrates he trains in Greek and in Macedonian weaponry around 30,000 young men from throughout the empire, which is, in other words, he's making an army that's about as big as his own. And he really seems to be willing to use this brilliant Persian administrative system that they had honed over 200 years to make his own, you know, sort of overlay on top of that his own power, but to work within their system rather than trying to kind of destroy it and build something else from scratch.
The time is 8:28. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, but this just in from the Associated Press. Kamala Harris has selected Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as running mate as she looks to strengthen the ticket in the Midwest, according to the Associated Press. Again, it is believed, being announced by Associated Press, Kamala Harris has selected Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate. More details should be coming at the top of the hour. Let's resume now the morning show. Already in progress. We are speaking with Rachel Couser about her book, Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. I am so intrigued by the title of the prologue, which is Alexander's Choice. And this is, of course, in a sense, the gateway to all the events that follow. And that is the choice that Alexander made in the wake of this tremendous success, this victory, which you say he won unexpectedly and definitively. What would he do next? And, of course, what may have been, in a sense, a simpler and easier choice was to return home and, in a sense, rest on your laurels. But Alexander's choice was very, very different, and that choice was to go east. Tell us more about what you think was going on at this moment in young Alexander's life and what you think was at the heart of this initial choice that he made.
That's a good question. I mean, I'm always cautious about saying, you know, what I think was going on in his mind. I try and think about, well, what did he know and what didn't he know? And I think the choice has to do with both of those. So what he did know was that at the time when he makes this choice to keep going east, the great king is still alive. He's been defeated, very definitively defeated, but he's still alive, and Alexander desperately wants to capture him, this guy Darius the Great, Darius III. But he also wants to be acknowledged as the legitimate ruler. So that's about capturing, killing something, Darius. And the other thing he knows is that he has gotten to maybe the middle of the empire. What he doesn't know is just how big the empire is, and he doesn't know to any extent, like, where it stops. And so, you know, I call this book Alexander at the End of the World, because in a number of the ancient literary sources, they say, well, he wanted to get to the end of the world. He wanted to get to this ocean that he thought lay at the end of the world. And obviously, you know, the world refused to end for him. And it was very hard for him to figure out, therefore, when to kind of put a bow on it and stop. And he really never does, as I get into more in the book. You know, it's basically his army finally says, like, enough already. We are going home. But I think that's sort of the tension that is playing out when he makes this choice.
I want to talk for just a moment about the destruction of the city of Persepolis. And you describe this event in the chapter called A City on Fire. And I think the way Alexander went about enacting this gigantic fire, which utterly destroyed this rich and powerful city, it says a lot about, in a sense, how complicated Alexander was, as well as how able he was. That, you know, in some ways this was a dramatic and audacious move, and yet it's one that he undertook quite methodically, and that was because of the extraordinary treasure that was thought to be housed in the heart of Persepolis. Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about and what we know about Alexander's careful plotting when it comes to this.
Thanks. That's a really great detail for you to pick up on. And I do think it's really key to his character. So we know that Persepolis had a huge treasury. The low estimate is 40,000 talents. And to put that into perspective, Athens, at the height of its empire, had an annual tribute that was about 1,200. So it's a huge, huge fortune. And we hear from Plutarch that he got together a massive number of camels and mules and loaded them all up with the treasure. He was in Persepolis for about 4 months and sent them off. And this is the middle of the winter, so it must have been quite a deal. The highlands of Iran, where Persepolis is, are not easy territory. Sent them off on a 300-plus-mile trip to another capital, Susa. And it's only when this is all done that he puts into place his plan for Persepolis, which is to burn it down. And it was striking to me, if you read the archaeological excavation reports, you know, that 40,000 talents, which is like tons and tons of gold and silver, not to mention all the other rich things that were in Persepolis, I think we found about 30 coins. So he really cleaned it out extraordinarily well. And that shows simultaneously his ability to plan ahead and then his kind of ruthlessness. Mm. Because I think the bigger question is sort of why he does it.
Right. And tied up with that is also another matter. You write, in wantonly burning down a rich and powerful city like Persepolis, Alexander took a calculated risk, one of the greatest in a career full of audacious moves. What was the nature of that risk? I mean, what was Alexander risking by doing this to the city of Persepolis?
Persepolis was a really important site for the legitimacy of the Persian king. It's an important royal site, and by burning it down, he was calling into question his claim that we talked about earlier to kind of be the true legitimate successor to the Persian king. And it certainly alienated a number of Persians, but I think he took that risk figuring that it was more important to send them this message like, your empire is over, it's time to come over to my side. And your king can't protect you any longer.
You describe in the chapter the hunt for the great king, his pursuit of this, in a sense, deposed king. Darius, is that how you pronounce the name?
You know, I mean, who knows how the Persians did it? Usually classicists say Darius.
Ah, Darius. And it looks like Darius, D-A-R-I-U-S. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, you describe this pursuit. And one of the things you tell us about that pursuit is that this was the first time, in your words, this was the first time Alexander had departed on a major campaign without Parmenion, a significant move for the young king. It was a declaration of independence. Tell us more about why this was such a significant moment in young Alexander's life.
So Alexander, when he came to the throne, he's 20, and he's surrounded by his father's generals and officers, Parmenion the most important of them. Parmenion was Philip II, Alexander's father's best general. And Parmenion remains the second in command through this period where Alexander is hunting Darius. But he's increasingly, I think, sidelined. By this point, Alexander's about 25, so he's feeling a little bit more willing to, how can I say this, to sort of do things on his own. And I think he's also getting frustrated in a way that's very characteristic of young people, I would say, with the kind of caution and maybe conservative outlook of Parmenion and of the Macedonian sort of traditional officers. You know, imagine if you're the king of this incredibly powerful place, but there's this guy that's your father's friend, and he keeps saying, don't do that. So that, I think, is sort of how Alexander saw many of the Macedonian officers in the time at the beginning of his career. So being able to sort of go out on his own, where he's going one way and Parmenion is staying back at the royal capital of Ecbatana, is a big change.
So he embarks on this pursuit of the king, Darius. And as you describe in the book, by the time Darius is found, he has already been killed by some of his own men, conspirators on his side. And that chase is over, but Alexander is not done. And as we've already said, instead of returning home, he is determined to press on further east, to the astonishment and maybe frustration of at least many of his men. We're speaking with Rachel Kauser about her book, Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. I want to ask you about what happens next, as you describe in the chapter, Old Friends and New Clothes. You write at the outset of this, with Darius's death, Alexander was deluged by a flood of Persian aristocrats switching sides. He had to decide whom to trust and how much. His decisions would transform his empire, integrating Persians into the highest echelons of the command structure, as well as the king himself. This is so interesting to think about. And of course, it's not the only time in world history that such a thing occurs. but it seems like an especially interesting challenge and array of choices that confronted Alexander. Tell us the way in which he went about, in a sense, integrating the conquered Persians into his army, into his leadership circle, and even into himself.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that I find most interesting about Alexander and most sort of relevant is that, you know, many people of his day, Greeks particularly, but also you get the sense Macedonians as well, really saw the Persians as different and not as good. So Aristotle, Alexander's tutor, famously supposedly told Alexander to treat, you know, the Greeks like allies and the Persians like animals or plants. Alexander's attitude was rather different. He was willing to incorporate them into his army, but he also married three times. Macedonian kings are polygamous, each time to an Iranian woman. He named all these Persian governors. He even started dressing. He didn't totally dress like a Persian, but he sort of combined Macedonian and Persian. So he had this purple cloak that was Macedonian-like, but a rich Persian color. Sometimes he wore a diadem, which is a band around your head, kind of like a headband. But that was conveniently something that both Greeks used for athletics, but the Persians used as a kind of sign of your high status. And he really tried hard to, you know, make this kind of new culture that would have what he calls at one point the sort of sharing and sort of thinking together of the Persians and the Greeks. The other thing to say about this, though, is it didn't always work, and he messed up a lot. And one of my favorite stories about him illustrates this. At this time, he's conquered about half of the Persian Empire, and he's captured the royal family, and he's dealing with the Persian queen mother, a woman named Sisigambis. And he one day gets a shipment of cloth and weavers from Macedonia. And he's all excited, and he sends them off to her and says, with a message that says, you know, if you and your granddaughters, the Persian princesses, like this, the weavers can tell you how to make more. And from a Macedonian perspective, this is a great gift because every good Macedonian woman is supposed to be a weaver. But from the Persian perspective, it looks really different because imagine if you're the queen and somebody sends you a mop and says, oh, I'll teach you how to mop the floor. So this messenger comes back to Alexander and says, you know, not only is she not happy, she has tears in her eyes. And so Alexander goes to her, to his credit, and apologizes and says, you know, my mother and my sisters made the clothes I'm wearing. I was misled by my own customs. And what we're seeing Alexander do at this moment is to sort of begin adjusting his worldview, which is pretty impressive for somebody who had the kind of untrammeled political power that he did. And it's that ability to kind of get outside his worldview and see things from a different perspective that I think made him so effective as a conqueror. And it's also relevant for today. The story, of course, also reminds us how hard that is and how important it is to be able to kind of change course and admit you're wrong.
Well, as we follow Alexander as he makes his way further and further east in this ongoing quest, one of the things that begins to complicate the picture are conspiracies, conspiracies against Alexander. And the way in which he responds, especially to the first major conspiracy, says a lot about who he was and his determination to not be brought down. Can you just say a word about kind of the nature of the conspiracies with which he had to contend, and especially the very first one that occurred, I think, in 330 BC?
Yeah. The first thing I would say is that both on the Macedonian side and on the Persian side, very few kings died in their beds. They tended to die in battle or they died by assassination. And Alexander had, of course, seen his father killed and also must have heard about a number of his father's brothers, further ancestors on his side, and then, of course, he saw Darius dead as well. So he must always have been kind of looking over his shoulder, I have the feeling. This particular conspiracy was, you know, supposedly involved at least one of Alexander's bodyguards, and there are only seven of them, and it's a very high-ranking position. So if it did, that is a serious conspiracy. It doesn't seem to have been terribly well thought out, and it was, in fact, betrayed by the lover of one of the conspirators, as I go into more in the book. But Alexander reacts to it very strongly, and takes the opportunity to use the fact that this has supposedly occurred and that the person who was first warned about it, Philotas, is the son of Parmenion, the kind of grumpy older guy that was Alexander's second in command, uses it to eliminate Philotas, Parmenion, their whole family. So he's both able to respond very quickly to what he sees as a threat, but he's also able to then recognize the opportunity this allows him to do something he probably wanted to do anyway. And that, again, is part of that kind of brilliant kind of ruthless improvisation that seems to be a part of his character.
I'm glad you mentioned improvisation, because in the chapter titled Across the Hindu Kush, where we're talking about him entering what's now Afghanistan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, this is by now the summer of 329, he has to draw upon what is seems to be a spirit of improvisation and innovation when he finds himself in what you describe as a discouraging, if not impossible, situation. But you go on to say one of the Macedonian king's strengths as a military leader was his ability to think differently, generating unorthodox solutions to the seemingly impossible challenges his conquest posed. I wonder if you remember this moment in which they need to find a way across a great river in very unconventional fashion. It's an amazing moment.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So at this point, the chief conspirator, a guy named Bessus, who is responsible for the assassination of Darius and who has modestly proclaimed himself great king as a rival to Alexander, has been retreating back north in Afghanistan, up into Uzbekistan, and he crosses this river and then burns all the boats. And there are no trees in this area. It's a pretty desolate area. And I think, you know, Alexander sort of gets there and he's looking across the river at, you know, all there is a bunch of burning boats. It must have been a rather discouraging moment. But Alexander takes a deep breath and gets all his men together and tells them to kind of sew up their tents and stuff them with straw and make them into rafts, and they float across. Which I am sure Bessus was not expecting. And it's just this brilliant, one of many brilliant sort of crazy solutions that he comes up with.
Absolutely. There's one unorthodox moment after another, and it seems to be one of the hallmarks of his leadership. Later in the book, you write about, this is again another completely different moment, but in this you write, Alexander demonstrated his unique combination of innovative, out-of-the-box thinking, coordinated and determined execution of his ideas, and an uncanny grasp of his enemy's psychology, so that he understood precisely what would make them submit. You tell a great story in the chapter called Murder at the Feast about an instance in which Alexander's recklessness was finally too much for his men. It involved a hunt, and it's a really, really great moment in the story of Alexander, if you want to just summarize it for our listeners.
Absolutely. So I talk about it more in my book, but they're in this beautiful hunting ground of the Persian kings called the Paradesos, which is the Persian word that gives us our word paradise. So you can imagine how gorgeous it is. It's full of trees and fruits and flowers, but it's also stocked, and this is probably what made it so cool for Alexander, with wild animals, particularly that the Persians could use for hunting. And as they're going through this, and Alexander loves hunting, he's always loved hunting, it's a big sport of the Macedonians. He's going through this paradise and he catches sight of a lion. And one of his officers had once famously killed a lion single-handedly. He got dangerously wounded in the process, but he had done it, and it was clearly a feather in his cap. And this guy sees the lion, and he's about to aim his spear, and Alexander angrily pushes him aside and says, "No, I'm going to do this myself." And he throws his spear and kills the lion in one stroke. His army is totally terrified. And you can imagine, like, he is way out in the middle of nowhere, close to what is now Samarkand in Uzbekistan. And they kind of sit him down afterwards and say, "You are never hunting on foot, and you are never hunting without a lot of bodyguards around you." And he agrees to this, but it's clearly not easy for him, and he may agree to it in that case, but as I talk about more in the book, like, in battle, he's still really hard to control.
Well, one of the maybe core messages of this story is the fact that Alexander has what seems to be an insatiable appetite for expansion of his empire. But he seems to be less interested in the matter of administering his empire. I mean, of having solid control over what he has already conquered. And it seems to me that that's maybe one of the most enduring lessons here, is that that there's something exciting, sort of sexy about conquering one more land, one more people, one more capital, whatever. And in some ways, the hard part is leading what you have. And the sense I have from reading your book is, although Alexander certainly demonstrated some skill when it came to that, maybe he demonstrated less interest in that. And one wonders if that was also what fed his incessant desire to go on conquering, that that, in a sense, was more fun, even though this period is really a checkered period in his career with plenty of defeats and reversals.
Absolutely. He was really good at conquering, and he was, how can we say this? He was less interested in just sort of staying in one place and governing. But I think it's also important to realize that what he did was to leave the system that the Persians had created in place. And I don't know that he gets enough credit for leaving well enough alone as opposed to trying to create his own new administrative system. So he co-opts, you know, many of the Persian king's most important subordinates. He empties his treasuries. He integrates Persian men into his army. And they have this really well-honed way of administering, which Alexander pretty much adopts. So, for example, he makes use of this Persian messenger system that is kind of like the Pony Express of the ancient world, and which allowed the Persians to get a message from Sardis at the western end of the empire to Susa in the center, which is about 1,500 miles. In about 12 days. So this is a kind of really sophisticated system that Alexander doesn't destroy, he just sort of uses. And we have a much better understanding in the last few years from a sort of burgeoning of Persian studies of just how well they did and how much he is just kind of using that, incorporating it, rather than doing, trying to create something new. So in a sense, I think that Alexander, you know, maybe was not as interested in administration, but he also recognized a good thing when he saw it.
Right. And in some ways, that was maybe a somewhat wise choice. Well, of course, the story goes on from there, and it is fascinating as we turn every page. And, of course, all of this ultimately ends with his surprising and untimely death in 323 BC. The story is extraordinarily interesting and told so very, very well. The book is Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great, published by Mariner Books. And the author, Rachel Couser. Rachel Couser, we've barely scratched the surface of your fascinating book, but I hope people have some sense of all of the interesting things that are to be found in it. Thank you so much for making time to be my morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to be here.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Our weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies, rain intermittent all day long. Swimming is not advised in Lake Michigan today for the entire listening area. Our high today, just 69 degrees with gusty northeast winds. Clear, windy, and mild overnight, a low of 61. By tomorrow, sunshine returns with a high of 75 degrees. Sunny Thursday, high of 79. Very pleasant conditions expected to continue all weekend long. This is WGTDHD Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva. WPR News from